Welcome to the Dirty Inning, a podcast where we talk about the worst innings in Phillies baseball. I'm Dr. Trevor Strunk, along with my good friend, Mr. Justin Clue, editor, boss, founding patron saint of The Good Fight, and we are part of the Good Fight Radio Network. Justin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Trev. Really appreciate you having me on. This is a new experience. I look forward to relishing it.
You know, come on again soon. It's really cool having you here.
Well, thanks for having me, and I'll talk to you again some other time.
All right, see you, Justin. Have a good night.
Well, folks, that's the kind of tomfoolery you can expect on this podcast. Just A-plus material for a full hour. We appreciate you listening to The Dirty Inning, so eloquently explained by Dr. Trevor Strunk in the intro. And yes, we are in fact part of the Good Fight podcast family, which you can join yourself if you have a family and need one, or if you have one already, and this one will be better. Feel free to subscribe, download, and become a part of the Good Fight podcast experience with Hittin' Season, Continued Success, and this podcast, The Dirty Inning. The most entertaining of the bunch, I would say. There's a lot of analysis that goes into the other two, a lot of emotional screaming, and in this case, in this one, this is much more of a narrative yarn spinning sort of podcast.
So, I would say so. I think we also, the other nice thing about this podcast is it is sort of like, it's a little more fancy free. I think a lot of your podcasts with Liz and John are certainly fancy free in many ways, but this one sort of has an unpredictable element, I would say.
Certainly does. Like, I don't think anyone's expecting me right now to tell them that we also have a Patreon, and for $5 you can become a member of it, and on that Patreon is a bunch of bonus content from this very podcast, as well as the others. But in this one in particular, we actually have a bit of a companion piece to this full episode of The Dirty Inning. We actually just did an episode for our $5 subscribers. About a few other players who have worn the number 3 for the Phillies after Bryce Harper has obviously selected to wear the number 3 as a member of the Philadelphia Phillies. We went back in time, found 3 lesser known members of the Phillies who wore the number 3, and
thanks for
outlined
calling them lesser known instead of before you called them sort of like lesser Phillies.
Yeah.
Which was reasonable, but they also had such good stories that I kind of felt like maybe they're just as good in some ways.
Yeah, I would call it subhuman is about the nicest way I'd go about phrasing anyone comparing themselves to Bryce Harper.
Just a bunch of warlocks.
But we did. We had a lot of fun breaking down the stories of those 3 guys, all of them with entertaining old school baseball tales of their own. But tonight,
Trev, they did some things that are not okay by today's standards. We canceled them.
Speaking of not okay by today's standards, the 1996 Phillies.
Oof, not okay by any year's standards.
Yes, oh, folks, boy. Tonight we'll be discussing a game, an inning from a game that occurred in the magical Phillies year of 1996. But before we get to that, Trevor, I have a question for you. Bet you weren't expecting that. Yeah.
I love it.
And that is, of course, do you remember your 5th birthday at all?
Ooh, 5th birthday.
What you were up to, who you were hanging out with at that point in your life, what bars you were hitting up.
You know, I was really into heroin at that period of time, so I didn't go to a lot of bars, mostly just like burned out houses.
Right.
Yeah, you know how that goes. Yeah. I don't know. I don't remember my 5th birthday, I don't think, but I do remember my 6th because it was on, I know this isn't the question, but it's kind of a funny story. It was on the, it was actually literally on Easter. It was maybe my one birthday ever that fell on Easter. So my birthday is April 19th, which is rarely an Easter day because it's too late. But it was this year. And so none of my friends could come to my party because I don't really know why this was, but either my parents or I didn't have enough imagination to hold my party on a different day. So we invited everyone to the party, and like 4 people showed up, and we just all went to see Fern Gully.
I love those memories you can think back on when, like, you were obviously trying to figure things out because you weren't a fully formed person yet, but also your parents were still figuring things out, just like adult life in ways you couldn't pick up on. And all 3 of you in that moment were just like, well, we probably could have done this a little better.
Yikes.
In hindsight, yikes.
Yeah, I was the first child, but also definitely Caitlin, my sister, never had a holiday. I mean, her birthday is September 8th, so it never is a holiday day. I mean, my birthday was definitely the first time any of us had to reckon with that. The idea that we were like, oh, right, everyone spends this day with their families, except us for some reason.
Well, it's tough. It's tough to go back that far and be cognizant of anything. Myself, I think I can remember my fourth birthday for some reason, because obviously I was at home with my mom during the day. There was like one of her friends and their kid was coming over to like, you know, give me an afternoon birthday celebration. And I remember getting a Berenstain Bears birthday card. For whatever reason, that stands out in my memory.
Ooh, but how was it spelled? Just kidding. Let's not do that.
I knew if I brought that up, you would bring that up. And yeah, I was going to say, we are not that deep of an internet podcast. We're not doing that, Trev. I'm drawing the line there.
Fine. I understand. You know what? It's okay.
This podcast may not exist without the internet, but we're not going to respect the internet on this podcast.
Frankly. I actually agree with this. I think the Mandela effect stuff is really irritating. Yes. Unless we could come up with a Mandela effect episode, in which case that would be pretty good.
All right. Well, I'm writing it down.
All right.
Pretending to write it down. Okay. I wrote it down. All right. What? You know who had a terrible fifth birthday, Trevor?
Who's that?
Well, this is only in theory, but we certainly aren't aware of the emotions of this particular 5-year-old boy on this particular birthday. But on August 7th, 1996, a young man in southern New Jersey by the name of Mike Trout was turning 5 years old. And uh-oh. August 7th is, of course, in the throes of baseball season, you might remember, Trev.
Yeah. No, I do. Guess what Mike Trout's doing on his birthday this year?
What's that, Trev?
Not being in playoff contention.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. That's the kind of that's why you're here. It's good stuff. Banter. Yes. Well, you know, not very long ago, I wrote a story for The Good Fight on Mike Trout, his birthday, and how it mattered in the Phillies' potential acquisition of him. I don't think I need to remind everyone, but I will, of the context of the Phillies' relationship with Mike Trout, which I've talked on other podcasts about how fascinating I am by his relationship with Philadelphia. Mike Trout from Millville, New Jersey, big Philadelphia sports
Never
fan
heard
growing
that
up
before.
You know, he's
from Millville?
Goes to all these sporting events, but
does
plays
he like
for
the
Angels.
Is he an Eagles? Is he one of those guys that likes the Cowboys or something? I don't know much about this guy.
Well, we do know he grew up a Philadelphia Phillies fan. And Trev, again, I don't know if you have heard this, but as
almost certainly not.
Countless columnists have informed us that when he is a free agent, he'll probably lean towards coming to Philadelphia because he grew up a Phillies fan. Now,
great,
we now split.
He's such a good player.
We now split the wrongness of that statement into two parts. The first part is, of course, that Mike Trout signed a contract extension with the Los Angeles Angels worth $430 million, as he should have and is worth every penny of. And that was mainly the point everyone would bring up when these misty-eyed, gray-haired writers would just like gaze into the distance and think, oh, I can't wait for Mike Trout to come home. When people would say, oh, we don't need Bryce Harper. I'd rather wait for Trout in 2 years. That really became something that people thought was like, yeah.
Such a good thing to think that we should just wait for a player that isn't on the market yet.
As if a player entering free agency is A, a guarantee, or B, once they're in free agency, as if it's a guarantee that you would get to sign them. I mean, it was all a bunch of variables.
He doesn't take any meetings with any other teams. He's like, oh no, I've planned to play for the Phillies forever for $1 a game.
I mean, this is why I was fascinated by his relationship with Philadelphia, because it just seemed like, yeah, he's obviously going to come play for the Phillies. But the longer that his career went on, the more it just seemed like, you know what? He seems perfectly content out there. Yeah, they're not winning a whole lot, but he doesn't seem like he's never made a point to want to get out of there. And just because he's from the Philadelphia area doesn't mean he's being drawn back to Philadelphia. Turns out he wasn't. And I brought up the story that I wrote for The Good Fight because the other part of the wrongness of that previous statement is I put forth the theory that perhaps the Phillies teams that Mike Trout grew up watching were not enough to make him as an adult think, you know what I really want to do is is really engage that fantasy I had when I was a child. Now, yes, the reaction to this story was, occasionally argumentative. And, really? You know, it was written somewhat tongue-in-cheek, I would say. I basically
SB Nation commenters didn't actually follow a tongue-in-cheek joke?
I said something like this on Twitter today. My favorite response has become people who say, look, I know this is a joke, but here are a bunch of serious corrections about it.
You know what's funny is, I just want to say this, I don't know if this is something you were planning on saying or not, but I've been thinking about Trout a little bit, and one of the things that is so funny to me about him is that he fulfills one of the old-timers, like, old-time baseball guys, like, favorite things, which is some player who just plays with the same team forever. Like, oh, you know, you pick a team and they're your family or whatever. Like, baseball writers love this and love thinking about it. And then once Trout signs the contract, you get a bunch of baseball writers who, and any other day, would, like, misty eye think about, like, Ted Williams and be like, I have a lifelong Red Sox. Like, every one of them was like, he's not going to get into the playoffs that way.
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah. They were obsessed with how irrelevant he'd made himself by staying in Los Angeles.
You guys, like, this is, like, your main fantasy.
Why? Yeah, like, all these writers, like, why doesn't he want to come here and interact with me every day? Like, why you are not making yourself that appealing, sir. You are not making yourself as appealing as $430 million, I can tell you that much.
Weirdly, yeah.
So there's been that very strange stepfatherly relationship Philadelphia and its writers have had with Mike Trout. Obviously, he's not coming here now, and
would you
that
want to
is
live with me and your mom.
and that is fine. It's shouted from the driver's seat of like a convertible he bought used from his friend for $600.
Mom, why did you marry this guy? He's just Philadelphia. He's authentic.
He's the mayor of Philadelphia. So in that story that I wrote, I went down each of Mike Trout's birthdays every year on August 7th from when he was born until he entered the league himself as a professional baseball player. And the Phillies lost most of those games. Now, granted, brutal. Yes, when he was a younger adult, the Phillies did, you know, go through that same brief 5-year golden era of winning the NL East and winning the World Series that we all enjoyed. But my theory was, during his most formative
winning
years...
Winning the World Series, huh?
Yeah. The Phillies won the World Series. Unless
I thought you
we
were saying,
have...
No, sorry. I thought you were saying when he was very young and you meant the 93 Phillies.
Oh, no. I did not mean that. No.
Oh, yeah. I was like, Justin is forgetting history.
Maybe we have slipped into another dimension. Huh?
I don't know if I'm ready for Lenny Dykstra, a World Series hero.
Well, in any case, he would have just sold his ring for whatever currency goes in prison these days.
Man, can you imagine Curt Schilling, World Series hero? Good thing we don't have to deal with that.
Yeah, fortunately, we don't live in that universe. Woo. Well, in any case, my point being that the Phillies never made themselves very appealing. If you just pick one day out of the calendar year when a young baseball fan wants to see his team win, you imagine it's his birthday. So, we picked the most egregious loss the Phillies suffered on Mike Trout's birthday when he was a child. In order to confirm, more or less, that is the reason why he did not want to come to Philadelphia. I mean, I think we can all agree that the reason he stayed in Los Angeles wasn't because he likes Los Angeles, it's because he didn't like Philadelphia.
I love
yes.
how, this is the other thing I really think is funny about Phillies fans, is that like every time we get like reasonably upset about like some player saying like, oh, I don't think they want to be in Philadelphia. It's like a second-rate city. We get furious and everyone gets so mad. And then anytime any free agent we like doesn't want to come to Philadelphia, it's like, I guess they didn't like Philly enough. It's like, or they liked where they are.
Oh, yeah. We love to take it personally. It's like, I would rather not play in that city. Why not? We're only the kind of people who become furious when that statement is made by a stranger and spend all day on social media trying to come up with like clever insults to get him back, even though he will never see them. You don't want to play in a city like that? God, yeah. I'm getting all worked up here, Trev. You got me all revved up just yelling at this hypothetical athlete. Who does he think he is? Why does he like our city? I also hate our city, but he can't hate it.
You so hate our city.
Well, I certainly would have hated it on August 7th, 1996,
Tell me all about it.
As the team that represents it absolutely got smashed by the Braves in Atlanta Fulton County Stadium.
Oh, the hated Braves.
I'm just going to give you one quick tidbit from this game so that you know the kind of tone we're setting moving forward. Phillies first baseman Todd Zeal. That's the okay. I will just see your reaction to that statement.
But that is, I mean, literally, that is my actual reaction to Phillies. It's just like a stunned silence. I've never heard this name before. Who could it possibly be?
Phillies first baseman Todd Zeal committed four errors, something that had only happened two other times in Phillies history. The most recent before this being like decades, but I think it was in like 1905, something like that. The Inquirer informed us of the historic nature of this event under the headline, "For who? For what?" But with, you know, four spelled like the number. Boy.
That's not very good.
This is brilliant.
I don't know.
So that's the kind of game we're looking at on this day. And the inning we will be focusing on will be the bottom of the third when the Braves scored the majority of their runs. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
And has any Philly we know, like that we would know from their playing days recently, committed four errors in a game? I feel like they must have, right?
Well, if you look at the bracket Matt Winkleman put together called March Badness, which is of all the former Phillies who don't play for the team anymore, but were members of the team from 2012 to 2017.
That was a really good bracket. I loved it.
Yeah, you could find probably your best candidates for a four-error game in that tornado of terrible baseball players.
Yeah.
Right there. But speaking of terrible baseball players, we got to...
It is the podcast, of course.
We got to introduce you to who was driving this train wreck, and that was a young man by the name of Bobby Munoz. Hmm. Ringing any bells, Trev?
You honestly could be making these players up from Ken Griffey.
Sometimes I am. But Bobby Munoz was acquired by the Phillies in 1994 in a trade that sent Terry Mulholland to the Yankees. Now, I don't know if you recall this, Trevor, but Terry Mulholland was, he was considered the Phillies' ace. Like Curt Schilling,
I do remember that. Yeah,
was pretty much taking over that role at this point. But for a while, Terry Mulholland was the Phillies' ace. Curt Schilling sort of impinged on that role in 1993 with some of his performances. And then when Mulholland left, it was like, all right, well, now it's Schilling's rotation. And in 1994, I mean, the Phillies were, remember, the defending National League champions. People forget that because instead of them defending their title, baseball ended in its entirety and none of the games counted. So
we never saw baseball again.
Because of the labor stoppage that year, when it came back the next season, the Phillies just weren't a good team anymore. And then they weren't a good team for almost, well, a little over 10 years.
It's funny. It's sort of like it's a version of the Expos that is like less talked about because it's not nearly as sad. The Expos, they were going to probably win the World Series in 94, and then they came back and they didn't, and now they're not even a team anymore.
Yeah, I'd say that story ends a little more sadly than the Phillies, but at the same time...
Just a little bit more.
There were you wonder how many missed opportunities there are in a situation like that. And as baseball heads for what has to be another inevitable labor stoppage, we are, of course, I don't know, it'd probably be good to go back and look at how many teams were really set up for a run that season that saw it ended. I mean, I don't know if the 93 Phillies were the beginning of a dynasty necessarily.
No.
I do think of them more as sort of an outburst of talent.
They were a flash
and luck
in the pan.
Yeah,
they could have had a Texas Rangers second run to the World Series like the Rangers did a couple years ago, where like they did that. Didn't they do back to back? Wasn't that them?
I believe so, but they lost twice.
Yeah, they lost both. Glad it wasn't me.
Fortunately for us, the Phillies didn't go to the World Series twice in a row. Phew.
I remember that was like one of the things that I remember Hulk Hamels, Peter, when he was still running the Good Fight. Said something like in a comment or like a game thread or something, but it was when the Phillies went to the 2009 World Series, and he was like, "You guys tired of this yet?" And he was like, "Just kidding, I'll never be tired of this." But I think about it a lot, and I think like, "Am I tired of this yet?" I think I was. I think
nope. I'm just tired.
Yeah, that's right. That's great. That's a good question. I wonder if the Phillies will be affected by that.
That's for some other Phillies history podcast to look up. I'm sure we'll never touch on that again.
No.
Well, Terry Mulholland had been at the time in 1994 the Phillies' most consistent pitcher. He'd been around for a few years. He was an established regular face and actually had his truck packed to head to Clearwater when he got a call on, I assume, a comically oversized 90s cell phone.
I can't hear you. I'm on a huge cell phone.
The Phillies informed him on that phone call that he didn't need to go to Clearwater. They sent him to wherever the Yankees had spring training. It wasn't Tampa yet, but instead he headed to Yankees camp. And the Daily News said that this trade came down to two questions. Question one: are the Phillies on paper better equipped to defend their National League pennant today than they were yesterday before trading their sturdy left-hander? Answer: no way. Question number two: why make the trade then? Answer: it's the money, stupid. This was an age where newspapers were really aggressive about insulting and hating their readers, which makes you wonder why this industry exploded at any point.
It's a real shame. How could we lose such a viable and good industry?
I am at least being a little facetious when I say that.
Oh, obviously. Yeah, me too.
Obviously, the newspaper played a key role, but it's if you go back and read like old sports pages, even from just 10, 20 years ago, you do notice a lot more snark, insults thrown at the audience, or certainly mockery at the player's expense, which is so funny good. Because there's like a chief complaint among like writers who are strictly online, who weren't in the clubhouse every day. Like, yeah, they could write whatever they wanted, but they wouldn't have to go look the player in the eye the next day. Whereas, you know, you go back and read some of these columns, some of these old Philadelphia columnists in the Daily News and the Inquirer, and you really get a sense that these guys either knew how to make eye contact pretty professionally, or they also did not have to worry about looking at these guys the next day, because they were very, very much mocked in the pages of these newspapers.
Yeah, it's brutal. I can't even imagine. Like, I can't imagine doing that. Like going into a newspaper and being like, yeah, this moron GM, like, such an idiot that he traded this guy, and then you might run into him the next day. Like,
oh yeah, and certainly just the business. Certainly never like going back and admitting that they were wrong. Like then, even when like they can make any claim or prediction you want, but like even if it's proven dead wrong, you just like don't bring it up. And back then, they didn't have to worry about people on Twitter being like, "Hey, remember when you said this?"
Yeah, it was only people who like saved newspapers in their house, and no one listens to them.
So who wouldn't, in 1996, give their pocket change for a stack of papers calling them stupid? In any case, Terry Mulholland was gone, having grown estranged, it said, from his teammates.
So he, like, according, it was a divorce.
He was just kind of out, I don't know, he's out of their orbit, which was interesting, given that it was only 1994. The year before, the team in 93 was obviously credited with having all this chemistry, which contributed to their success.
To this day, it's contributed with all that chemistry, yeah.
So, yeah, it makes you wonder what exactly would cause someone to grow estranged from a team that was such well-documented to be close-knit. But the future was now in the hands of one of the Phillies' gains in the trade, a 26-year-old starting pitcher by the name of Bobby Munoz.
Oh no.
Who had debuted for the Yankees the previous year.
Phillies trade with the Yankees, it's always so bad.
Well, here's hoping that upon being informed of the news, Munoz was not intimidated by neither filling the role of a respected, effective veteran, nor pressure applied by any unstable teammates, because according to the Inquirer, well, let me just, Lenny Dykstra and Jim Fregosi were asked, like, about the trade, and Dykstra said they couldn't sign him, about Mulholland, they couldn't sign him, and they knew he could walk, but if Munoz pitches the way he says he can, it could be a good deal. I gotta tell you, hearing Lenny Dykstra's like, well, this guy better be good, or the deal is bad, that just feels like, you know, Dykstra, I feel like his patience is probably razor thin and easy to punch through, especially if you're a struggling young pitcher. Because he goes on to say, the paper says, but Lenny, what about 1994? Lenny says, I'm not denying nobody in baseball would. That left-handed starting pitchers are to, sorry. I'm not denying nobody in baseball would. That left-handed starting pitchers are hard to come by. So this is at this point, left-handers are enough of a commodity that at this point, trading away Terry Mulholland is seen as like dumping some you know precious resources down into a gully of some kind.
Right,
so
right.
Yeah. But you know, they got Bobby Munoz back, and that just had to be good enough. Manager Jim Fregosi, according to the paper, manager Jim Fregosi talked about getting an infusion of young talent into the system.
Oh,
you have to have good. You have to have that influx, and Munoz has closer type stuff. Hopefully he can make the club. Terry Mulholland was a great pitcher here, and he did a hell of a job for us. But at this stage, with 1 year left on his contract, the players we got should help. But yeah, I want to go back to that initial part
closer
of that quote.
Like stuff, huh?
Hope he makes the team. I have the utmost faith in this player and his skills that I heard about today for the first time. Presumably, he will be good enough to be on the team next year.
I really like we traded our number two pitcher for a guy who looks like he might have closer stuff.
This is the kind of guy you bring in to face three hitters at the end of a game. Thank you.
I know they valued the closer more than I get that, but not that much more.
At the same time, he's coming off seeing Mitch Williams be the most maligned closer that anyone's ever seen
true.
In Philadelphia.
Yeah, I guess Jim Fregosi is probably thinking like, hopefully I can get rid of. Hopefully so I never have to answer another Mitch Williams question ever again.
When he says he has closer type stuff, he might mean that, like, this guy looks like he could throw a terrible pitch that ends your World Series hopes forever.
Just the kind of thing all the Phillies fans wanted to hear.
Well, Bobby Munoz made his debut for the Phillies early in April, coming out of a bullpen that no longer had Mitch Williams in it. You'll be pleasantly surprised to know. He was a person that still brought a shudder to the Philadelphia sports scene. One newspaper columnist simply referred to Mitch Williams as, quote, you know who. But Munoz. Yeah, right. But Munoz came out during a Phillies game in Colorado, the novelty of which is still apparent in the writing about it, and by which I mean the novelty of a baseball game in Colorado, given that this was only the Rockies' second year in existence. And this he made his debut just as a winter storm had been conjured over the mountains.
By you know who.
And descended on Denver. The city starts simmering with excitement as the snow started to fall, and all the fans were like, oh, it's snowing during a baseball game. This is wild. And just as Munoz enters the game. Later on, Munoz would say, you can't make excuses, but it was cold out there after walking three batters in one-third of an inning. There was a story printed in response to the game about Munoz walking two hitters on eight pitches in the minors with the Yankees, and when he got pulled from that game, his manager found him sitting in the shower with his head down in his uniform after all the other players had cleared out. Munoz got a pep talk and wound up throwing 23 scoreless innings in a row after that. So Munoz was somebody that, with a few expectations lobbed at him, who rose a little bit to the occasion. In 1994, he finished with a 2.67 ERA in 21 games and 15 starts. Yeah. 1995 was not as good, as he had Tommy John surgery, only made three starts for the Phillies and allowed 10 earned runs and 9 walks in 15 and two-thirds innings.
Yikes.
But in 1996... Bobby Munoz was ready to bounce back in a big way. He appeared in six games. The 1996 Phillies lost every one of them.
Oh, no. When does he bounce back and become a world-class pitcher, Justin?
Oh, Trev, I got some real, real bad news. Yes. And we'll get to that bad news. We'll get to that bad news right after this break. On August 7th, 1996, the Phillies took the field at Atlanta Fulton County Stadium for a 7:37 start against the Braves. At home, we can only assume that a 5-year-old Mike Trout was watching his favorite baseball team, the Phillies of the late 90s, and we are left to wonder what exactly about this sport made Trout want to not only play it, but play it better than anyone.
I'm imagining that meme that's the guy saying, oh boy, I just got out of a 5-year coma. I can't wait to see my, and like, it's just like something that isn't around anymore. I just imagine Mike Trout being like, oh, I just got out of not being able to watch baseball for like 4 months. I can't wait to watch a start by Terry Mulholland, my favorite Phillies pitcher.
I'm 5 years old. I'm cognizant and starting to log memories. Can't wait to see Terry Mulholland.
Dad, will Big Terry be pitching? He will, son.
He sure will, son. Loading a shotgun. He sure will. The rules are different in Millville, all right? Southern New Jersey's the Wild West. I don't make the rules. Anyway, the point is this.
No one does in Southern New Jersey.
August 7 is, of course, Mike Trout's birthday. As a kid who loved sports and especially baseball, he was probably allowed to watch an inning or two before bed of his favorite red pinstriped pals doing their thing in 1996.
Pinstriped pals makes it sound like they're like He-Man characters or something.
Yeah, he goes to bed and they just come out and go, "Oh, hey, Mike Trout, it's me, Alex Arias."
Wow. Can we play so cool. Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. You'll join us on another mediocre at best baseball adventure with your best friends, Ricky Otero, Kevin Sefcik, Wendell McGee, and Gene Shaw. They call us the Red Pinstripe Gang, and they hate us. You will too. And he's like waiting for them to open the window and fly away, but they all just like sit down,
start lighting cigarettes.
Yeah. Scoot over. I haven't slept in a bed in 3 years. This is great. Well,
hi there, little boy. I'm Alex Arias. This is the saddest thing you could ever hear.
I think I'm like a generation ahead mentioning Alex Arias. He's just the first one of those guys who always pops into my brain.
It's
I think he was very funny. He was an early 2000s forgettable Philly, not a late 90s. Forgive me, listeners. If there's one thing you should expect of me, it is to be able to know the difference. Well, this is where this theory came from. Like, there's a lot of assumptions I'm making, but I don't think they're grounded in like a complete fantasy world. If it was my birthday, my birthday's in mid-October. The Phillies were not playing baseball in mid-October when I was growing up around this time as well.
You had to enjoy all those Yankees games that you loved so well.
If the Phillies were playing baseball on my birthday, I, as a child, would have wanted to watch them. And I feel like Mike Trout was, you know, as much, if not certainly more, of a baseball fan than I was when he was a child.
Well, you were better than him at baseball, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's because of the reach. It's because of the length of my – I have longer arms, so because of the release point, and if we factor in solar winds –
Yeah,
then,
which, I mean, you have to.
I think there's a statistic out there that would show I'm the best player of all time. So, yeah, I totally agree. Analytics, thank you. Broke that down pretty easily. I think we're very clear. Now, providing no evidence to that previous statement, August 7th, yes. All right, Mike Trout's birthday. So that's what I'm saying, that as a child, he was probably watching this game, at least part of it, and the Phillies certainly lost it. And I would have been upset watching my favorite team lose a game this poorly. I imagine his Millville, New Jersey bedroom was decked out in pennants and baseball stock art. And before his eyelids closed on a fun summer day, now a year older and kindergarten ahead of him in the coming school year, he got his birthday wish to see the Phillies play, and his parents got their wish that he'd be asleep before the Phillies finished losing 14-1.
Well, at least he wished low. Like, at least his only wish was to see them play.
Happy birthday, Mikey.
So sad.
This is also from the Inquirer. Would Bobby Munoz, who was making his sixth start of the season after undergoing Tommy John elbow ligament surgery a year ago, outduel the All-Star Game starter? He was facing John Smoltz on this day for the Braves.
So John Smoltz is not good, right?
No, he's good at this point.
No, I was kidding, John Smoltz.
Oh, I thought, well, early in his career, there was some kinks John Smoltz had to iron out. So did Tom Glavine. And, like, the Braves being patient with them is considered one of those, like, big baseball payoffs. That was not going to happen with Bobby Munoz. The paper goes on to write, would the Phillies commit more errors in one night than the 1980 team made in the whole season? The answers? No, no, no. John Smoltz, like I said, got the mound for the Braves that day, so the Phillies lineup was rendered useless immediately. It was up to the 26-year-old Bobby Munoz and his 20 games under 500 teammates to go tit for tat with the future Hall of Famer Smoltz. By the end of the third inning, the tits remained untatted, and the Phillies were down 9-0. So as I said, this game took place in Atlanta, but up in Philadelphia, 1996 was quite a year for one city landmark. Trev, if you've ever driven down South Columbus Boulevard to the IKEA, past that restaurant that used to be called Champs, where my college girlfriend got food poisoned, and nearby I think there's a Chick-fil-A, the parking lot of which I once met a guy to sell some of my old college textbooks on Craigslist. You've undoubtedly looked to your left and been startled to see an enormous steamer ship about to come flying out of the river and smash your car in half. Well, no fear, Trevor. That's just the SS United States, which was docked there pretty much permanently in 1996.
Truly the worst name for a ship you could possibly want. The USS United States.
Well, this is this was 96
called?
Was
it's called the USS My Country.
let's not think harder about this. This is we have time for a first draft and nothing else. But at one point the ship had become a 2,000 passenger luxury liner, but the idea was, you know, should there be another reason for it to be a battleship, it could also be turned back into a 14,000 soldier vessel. So in 1996, the SS United States was docked pretty much permanently where it is now, near South Columbus Boulevard. A developer who had brought it there passed away. And it was eventually purchased by Norwegian Cruise Line in 1994. The point of that was to obviously turn it into a cruise ship. But in 2010, the Norwegians decided they weren't interested anymore, so they put the ship up for sale.
Classic Norwegians.
To be scrapped, those shifty Norwegians. So the scrapping bids, you know, the deadline for the scrapping bids to be turned in was fast approaching. And the day before they were going to be accepted, philanthropist H.F. Jerry Lenfest, who was one of the three owners, of the Philadelphia Media Network when I worked there as a sports producer for Philly.com, he actually offered the conservancy that was protecting the ship, it was a national nonprofit, he offered them almost $6 million for the ship and so that they could maintain it for about 20 months.
Wow.
So this deal came to pass in February 2011, 15 years after the ship arrived, and the conservancy became the owners of the ship, and it was their job to put together a real estate deal that would make it a stationary attraction. And people consider that that Lenfest's intervention was something of like the Hidden City, Philadelphia, which is the site that I got this from. Tremendous resource for anyone looking to get more information on Philadelphia architecture, landmarks, anything that makes the city a city. They referred to him as a guardian angel intervened just as the wrecking crew arrived at New York's Pennsylvania station half a century ago. So, that was going on in Philadelphia at this point. But the Phillies were playing in Atlanta, and a defunct cruise ship would be of no help to them on this evening. Because in Atlanta... 1996. Trev, do you know what was going on in Atlanta?
Yeah, the Olympics.
Welcome to the Summer Olympics. Or welcome to what had been the Summer Olympics. They actually wrapped up 3 days before this game was played. And like most cities that have hosted an Olympics, Atlanta was thriving.
Uh-oh.
No, the Olympics, the Braves had Olympics fever, even though the Olympics being in Atlanta meant they had to go on an unprecedented 19-day road trip.
Uh-huh.
And just couldn't be in town
easily that year.
All right, that's a good point. They were also the World Series champions at this point too. So, but the Braves, they actually held a tryout for a gold medal javelin thrower from the Czech Republic after noting a parallel in how he threw his javelin and the mechanics of hurling a baseball.
How'd it work out?
Which is interesting. They had this tryout. It lasted like a half an hour. The scouting director for the Braves, Paul Snyder, said, "We were not disappointed one iota in what we saw. The arm strength we anticipated was there. The athleticism we anticipated was there. We will pursue it. The next step for him is that he has quite a lengthy track schedule into the fall, but we would like to see if he can dedicate himself to baseball for 30 days next spring, and we'll see what happens." Weird, right?
Very strange.
Okay, like, weird. Like, feels like a publicity stunt that, like, Atlanta is like, all right, look, Braves, can you just, like, do a thing here with us? And, we'll get some coverage for this. I don't know, but it's weird.
What's so weird about it is him saying, like, yeah, went off without a hitch, and we'll definitely see him again soon.
Like, well, Yeah, and Zalesny, Jan Zalesny is this guy's name, and he said that, like, oh, I would love to go to spring training. I like baseball very much, even though I'd actually never thrown a baseball before today. He also was struggling with the glove when he would get the return throw from the catcher. He kept dropping the ball. But one of the things they had him do, just because of his pure arm and throwing strength, and I'll just read this. This is from Paul Hagen wrote this in the Inquirer, in the Daily News. Zalesny topped off his tryout with an impressive display of arm strength. Using his javelin technique but throwing a baseball, he tried to throw a ball from foul territory in right over the fence in left center. The first throw rolled to the fence. The second short hopped it. The third cleared it with several feet to spare.
Yikes.
So the arm strength was there. That is true. So it makes you think, man, maybe he should have been like an outfielder. Not a pitcher?
You can't, like, I mean, that's the problem. Like, we were talking about this in the bonus episode. Like, it's like that Oakland Athletics, the guy in the A's who was the pinch runner. And, like, it's cool, it's a neat idea, and, like, you take, like, an Olympian and make him a pinch runner or whatever. But, like, it just doesn't work. Like, baseball's hard. It's, like, a very specific set of skills. You can't just map them on to other things.
I wonder if this is still something teams do. Look for guys who play other sports that have, like, the raw mechanics down, theoretically, to play baseball. It seems like they don't, because it does have a very... It almost seems like a childlike understanding of this. You know what I mean?
I mean, I know they do it in football. The Eagles drafted the rugby player, Jordan Malaita, who literally was just a rugby player. Wasn't like there was any element that he never played football before. And their punter is an Australian rules punter, so, like, I mean,
clearly, so it works out.
Yeah,
it does, in some cases. Yeah,
but, like, man, I don't know, like, it's I can't imagine baseball teams actually do this. I mean, why would they?
Well, the Braves weren't doing anything in Atlanta at this point, obviously being on the road, like I said, during the Olympics. Muhammad Ali lit the cauldron to open the Olympics. There were actually two opening ceremonies because Savannah, Georgia was also hosting some events and was far enough away that they figured they'd have their own party. It's the first time in Olympics history that two different opening ceremonies were held. The closing ceremony featured Boys to Men singing the national anthem. Then there was a massive stadium-wide card-flipping trick followed by daredevil stunts from BMX skate and skateboarders. Because those sports were invented in the United States. Celine Dion performed. Yeah. Celine Dion performed. Gloria Estefan performed. And 600 Atlanta children sang the song The Power of a Dream, then screamed, "Y'all come back now," in unison when they finished.
Terrifying.
Centennial Olympic Stadium, a central facility to the games, was right next door to Atlanta Fulton County Stadium. And soon after this, Atlanta Fulton County would be shut down, torn down. The Braves would move into Centennial Olympic Stadium, rename it Turner Field, and one entire and a facility that would see one World Series in 23 years.
Good burn.
Like to get those burns in there. Way to win the World Series, 90s Braves. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, there was also word in the newspaper in Atlanta and elsewhere that meteorites that had been found in the Arctic contained possible evidence of life on Mars. But nobody was talking about meteorites at Atlanta Fulton County Stadium on August 7th.
The Millville meteor?
Boy, that would have been a far superior transition, wouldn't it? Well, didn't think of that. At least, so at least they weren't talking about meteorites or better transitions than the one I drafted at first. But later in the sitting, Bobby Munoz was probably praying for a few of them to hit the stadium. Munoz was on the ground, and the Phillies were down 3. Munoz was on the mound. He was okay. He wasn't on the ground.
He was dead.
Munoz was down. Muhammad Ali got to him. It was bad. Bobby Munoz was on the mound, and the Phillies were down 3-0 after a 2-run Javi Lopez bomb and an RBI single by Marquise Grissom in the second. Then in the third inning, with Bobby Munoz about to meet his maker, Chipper Jones led off. A young Chipper Jones, who had only just made his first All-Star team that season. And he tells the story of that in his autobiography that is just called Ball Player. It was probably fitting that Bobby Cox, who had made me the number one pick in their draft and batted me third as a rookie, also named me to my first All-Star team. Bobby was the National League manager for the 1996 All-Star Game by virtue of our World Series win the year before. He called me into his office in early July with a little shit-eating grin on his face and said, "You've had a great first half and you deserve to go. I'm taking you to the All-Star Game." I was hitting around 300 with 17 homers at the break, about the same as Giants third baseman Matt Williams, but I didn't have his track record, and fans voted him in over me. But I was one of six Braves Bobby took to Philadelphia, including Fred McGriff, John Smoltz, Greg Maddux, Tom Glavine, and Mark Wohlers. Leading up to the game, Matt Williams actually got hit in the elbow, so Bobby Cox named Chipper Jones the starter at third base, with Ken Caminiti backing him up. So, Bobby Cox took six Braves to the All-Star game in Philadelphia, the last All-Star game to be held in Philadelphia, hey, come on, by the way.
That's
I'm pretty sure. What was it, who was the only All-Star that was Ricky Bitalico, the Phillies All-Star that year?
Yeah, he was. I remember that.
Well,
Ricky Bitalico.
Yeah.
That's a rough one.
So at the tail end of that 19-game road trip the Braves had been forced on because of the Olympics, in the second-to-last game in Los Angeles, which went into extras, went into the 13th inning, and was also a day game following a night game, the Braves' nerves were getting a little frayed at this point, and Chipper Jones had been ejected, bitching about balking Bob Davidson's strike zone. But they were nice and refreshed facing the Phillies on August 7th. They were back to their normal Braves form, which would take them all the way to the World Series again. And Chipper Jones led off with a double, then scored on the Fred McGriff single that followed him. Bobby Munoz then walked Ryan Klesko, and with two runners on, Jim Fregosi ended Bobby Munoz's evening for good reason. And Bobby Munoz's career would last through 1997, but that was it. That was the end of old Bobby Munoz,
man,
and the fruits of the Terry Mulholland trade.
Was he the only thing they got back?
No, there were other players involved, I believe, that went both ways. But no, he was the only one I mentioned because he was the only one that pitched for the Phillies on August 7th, 1996.
Cool.
But fortunately, the Phillies had Ron Blazer come into the game, a 24-year-old reliever who would appear 63 times for the Phillies in 1996 and 1997.
Is that 'cause
then
he was
never.
Good?
No, it's not.
Oh, no.
I can say with some confidence that it was not because he was good. The Phillies, you'll find, Trev, in this era, really did not
have good players.
No, and I'm sorry, I was factually wrong there. I was going off the top of my head, and I said Ron Blazer's statistics instead of Bobby Munoz's. Bobby Munoz's career lasted from 1993 to 2001. Mm-hmm. However, there was a gap from after 1998. He didn't appear in Major League Baseball in 99 or 2000. And he rarely had, starting in 1996 with the Phillies, his season ERA was 7.82 in six games.
No.
The next year for the Phillies, in eight games, he had an 8.91 ERA. With Baltimore in 1998, he made into nine games, had a 9.75 ERA. I don't know why he kept getting these chances.
That's terrible, yeah.
It just get, with
just
more
really
exposure.
I mean, that's just
with
like,
more exposure, he just kept giving up more runs.
Yeah, I mean, there's there is a point at which you just have to say, like, well, I mean, maybe this guy has great stuff, but it's never going to show up. We need to stop. We need to stop forfeiting games to try and get this guy right.
The Expos thought that again in 2001 when they gave him another shot. And in 15 games, he had a 5.14 ERA. He went 0-4. They let him throw 42 innings. I mean, you know.
Hey.
Sometimes, yeah, maybe it was just his raw stuff.
Yeah,
you never know.
It would have to be at that point. Maybe he knew someone.
At that point, yeah. Maybe, you know, maybe it was just best buds with the guy who invented the Expos, John Expo.
That guy sucks. I hate him.
But Ron Blazer came in to relieve Munoz in this game, a 24-year-old reliever who, like I said, his career would be over after 1997. There was a writer named Hank Davis who met Blazer earlier in his career when he was playing in the minor leagues. And Hank Davis, who was Canadian, was writing this book and talking to the bullpen Blazer was a part of while they were in Hamilton in Canada for a game, which I believe is in Ontario.
Okay.
They got to talking about the differences between the U.S. and Canada and realized that the price of beer was $24 for a case in Canada, something that Blazer and the rest of the bullpen could not believe. And for this reason,
Hank
Davis talks about Ron Blazer like he's a complete idiot. where he writes, I try to explain the currency differential, but international finance does not go down too well in the Batavia bullpen. All they know is if you're using things that look like dollars, you should not have to trade 24 of them for a case of beer, even if it's better beer than they can buy around Buffalo, and even if those dollar bill looking things are only worth about 75 cents in real money. If Blazer doesn't have a future in high finance, he also nearly missed the boat with professional baseball. I mean, good Lord. There's no way Blazer doesn't know he's in a book that someone wrote. And that means he definitely like found his name on this page and was like, huh, well.
Is that what that was about?
I thought we were just like talking. This guy was like.
This guy was writing notes on his book.
Ron equals idiot in his notebook. That sucks. Wow.
This is going to be a really funny chapter.
Something weird happened in Blazer's career. He was signed in July 1989, a story that went largely unreported except by his hometown newspaper, which excitedly summed up how the local boy had made good, concluding with the sentiment, "All in all, Ron Blazer has had a fabulous high school career, but perhaps the best is yet to come." Mm. Scouts saw him in 1989, according to Davis, and thought Blazer's stuff was so good but so raw that they didn't sign him to rookie ball. This is the weird part. They gave him $500 and a list of 20 things for him to correct about himself. Before they inserted him into their farm system. This is true. So he goes to the Appalachian League, works some shit out, and eventually returns to the Phillies, makes the AAA roster in Scranton, becomes the closer, and gets promoted to the big leagues in 1996.
So is it like the stuff to work out, is it all baseball stuff? Or does it?
I believe it was largely baseball stuff.
I'm just thinking about, like,
but I don't know.
Just like work out the problems in your life. Like, commit to, be able to commit to a relationship, or, you know, just like, you're too scared.
I will say
of
this.
Stuff.
20 things is a lot of just baseball things to ask a baseball player to correct about himself so that you, a professional baseball team, can draft. Isn't 20 high enough number that you would think they'd be like, you know what? There's probably a guy who we'd only have to fix 10 things about, and then we can make him the pitcher and spend less time. Also, why'd they give him $500? This was strange.
It's
to
very
me.
Weird. Like, it's, yeah, that's odd. I think, like, the weirdest part about it to me is that, I mean, the weirdest part about it to me is that, like, you'd give a pitcher a list of things to fix at all. Like, what do you say? Like, learn a curveball? Like, try and add a couple miles an hour to your fastball, and then we'll sign you? Like, that's bizarre.
Yeah, you got weak ankles. Do some more ankle workouts.
Get strong.
So that was Blazer's circuitous route to the major leagues, but he was going to blaze a trail through the rest of this inning.
Come on.
But it would also be a circuitous trip to the end point. By now, he had a 4.81 ERA on the season after 22 appearances and would finish with it almost at 6. His season ERAs for both years he was in the majors were over 5, and in this inning, it's easy to see why, and we'll find out after the break. Hard-hitting Mark Whitten was the first batter Ron Blazer would face after relieving Bobby Munoz.
Does he hit hard?
I was just about to say, and he lived up to his name, smashing a single to right field. But an error on Jim Eisenreich allowed everybody to move up an extra base and a run to score. Mm. Errors were the main character of this game. Todd Zeal, like I mentioned, was in the middle of moving from third base to first base.
From his apartment to another apartment.
When he was smashed in the arm by an assailant holding a tire iron. And for that reason, committed 4 errors the next day. Nope, Todd Zeal, perfectly healthy, normal, just being moved from being a third baseman to a first baseman. And he alone on this night would give the Phillies 4 errors, as I mentioned, tying a league record, but also struck out 3 times.
Yikes. That sounds like a bad night for Ryan Howard. Like one of those nights where you're just like, oh, Ryan, oh no.
So, yeah, no, it absolutely does. And Zeal said of his positional shift, I never said I relished it or that I was looking forward to it after this game. So he didn't want to move to first base, but also, I mean, Trev, this might be a way too surface level take on this, but third base is certainly a more challenging defensive position than first base.
Yes.
So 4 errors, new high in single game errors being made at first base, a position where obviously it's as tough as any baseball position, just, you know, fundamentally to field the ball, but you're not doing as difficult a job as third base, which is where he was coming from.
I mean, I make fun of, I sort of like joke around about how you're more, and actually they're not jokes, they're all real, how you are better and more equipped to play in the major leagues than the people we talk about. But you did play third base, so like that was your position, wasn't it?
No, I was a first baseman, and the reason for that was that it was not as difficult a defensive position to play as third base.
I see. All right.
Well, the Phillies really dropped the ball, you might say.
I would never say that.
And the Inquirer did
say
it.
Why do you think I would?
They said that, and then they said, and dropped it, and dropped it, and dropped it, and dropped it, and dropped it.
Gotta admit, that's a good bit.
Again, burning the Phillies in the newspaper. We did not play well, Jim Fregosi said. So Eisenreich's error was quickly forgotten as Javi Lopez singled in the next run, and Mark Lemke hit a sac fly to bring in another. At this point in the third, it's 7-0 with one out. Jeez. Ron Blazer's still in the game and would remain so for the rest of the inning, though the papers wouldn't even mention his name. They focused more on Munoz and how he hadn't fully recovered from Tommy John surgery yet, and how the Phillies didn't really have a starting pitcher at this point who it seemed like who could give them more than two or three innings. So, thankfully, it was the pitcher's spot next, and since John Smoltz was bunting and not pitching, he was mostly harmless. His bunt was an easy out, the second of the frame, putting runners on.
I was shocked. I thought there was going to be an error there.
I mean, I was gonna, like putting runners on, but it doesn't matter where the runners were. The runners were everywhere. The sky was blackened by clusters of Braves base runners. They filled the air like cicadas. Marquise Grissom came up next and smacked a ground ball that meant the inning could end, but the Phillies weren't done having fun yet, and a throwing error from Scott Rolen, of all people, kept the inning alive.
Good thing we got rid of that.
Again, Gold Glove third baseman Scott Rolen. The reason Todd Zeal is at first base making all those errors. Made an error himself. Thanks, Scott. Two base runners became three when Ron Blazer walked Ed Giovinola, and with the bases loaded, Chipper Jones returned to the batter's box.
Well, that's never a bad time to have Chipper Jones in the batter's box, right? He's not dangerous or anything.
After walking Ed Giovinola, a guy who is a textbook defensive middle infielder and not someone who needs to be on base for any particular reason. I mean, this is a guy who in 1996 hit .232 in 43 games, and the year before hit .071 in 13 games.
I'm listening. That all sounds really good.
I, an expert measurer of baseball talent, say that that's very good. Well, Chipper did his best to end the inning too, but Zeal used the opportunity of the bouncing ground ball headed for his position to commit one of his many errors on the evening, and I think he actually committed two.
Oh, jeez.
one trying to field the ball, and one trying to salvage the play by throwing out one of the runners as they advanced after the miscue. Both errors allowed a run to score. Two runs came in on one play. It's 9-0. There's two outs. The last two Braves hits have been errors by the Phillies.
How many outs was the... So, like, by the time it was two outs, how many runs did they have?
Nine. It was 9-0.
I guess by the time the second out was made. Let me ask a better way. How many of these runs came about on the second out?
I believe they added two more runs. Yeah, they added two more runs on these two plays that they committed three errors on. Two runs, three errors, two plays.
Truly horrible.
Mm-hmm. So mercifully, Fred McGriff grounded out to end this atrocity, but the Braves weren't done. Ryan Klesko, Fred McGriff, and Mark Whitten would all score three runs each. As the Braves would go on to win 14-1. They were fueled by their six-run third inning that had been mostly keyed by Bobby Munoz and Ron Blazer. To Blazer's credit, because of Munoz's terrible start to the inning and the boneheaded defensive theatrics happening around him, he actually allowed no earned runs in an inning where the Braves scored six times.
That's not to his credit.
To his credit. They were unearned runs, Trev. He didn't earn them. That's like saying they're not his fault.
Why would you ever say that's to his credit? You're going to get so many mad letters now.
I'm just trying to salvage Ron Blazer's feelings for this.
Please don't.
This terrible, terrible inning he orchestrated.
Salvage poor Bobby Munoz's feelings, whose career was over, and partially because Ron Blazer decided that he wanted most of those runs not to go on his thin waistline or whatever.
Well, Trev, the minimum time at this point for a game to be delayed by Major League Baseball before being called was an hour and 15 minutes. In the eighth inning of this game, with the Phillies down 14-1, the Braves loaded the bases again with one out. And thankfully, the heavens opened, the rain poured down, and everybody waited exactly 1 hour and 15 minutes before packing it in. The writers say the players had already changed into street clothes, and the dugouts were empty, and the equipment was gone 30 minutes before the cancellation was official.
Hey, I mean, why would you bother otherwise? I mean,
why bother? The 1996 Phillies video yearbook. Yeah.
I love that, poor Michael Trout is watching this, and not only is it a terrible game, there is a rain delay. Like, there's nothing a kid hates more than a rain delay.
I loved rain delays watching the game at home. In my mind, it just meant that, like, oh, you know, the baseball will continue maybe forever. Like, I didn't have in my head exactly how that situation would play out. In the stadium, hell on earth. Yeah.
Right.
Especially if concessions are closed, and it was the eighth inning, so they were. And I remember, was it in the World Series this past year that the game went to 18 innings and they reopened concessions? And I remember tweeting about this, saying, like, that was my ultimate fantasy as a kid, that the closed concession stands would reopen.
Can you imagine how horrible that would be for the people actually selling concessions?
Why would they must have been ordered from on high. Yeah, like, there's no way, you know.
Yeah, like, everyone's getting time and time and a half.
What a terrible message to receive. Like, you're in the car ready to go home. Like, we need you upstairs back on the grill.
Hungry people who are mad about baseball need food.
Well, that is the story of how Mike Trout turned five, sort of. A lot of assumptions are made about what exactly he was doing on this day, but we do know, you know, by many countless accounts, that he was a Phillies fan growing up. And at 5 years old, he was in the middle of growing up, and the Phillies played one of the worst games of their season, and I would say the worst game of the games they've played on his birthday throughout his life.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since I read your article, so I can't pull all of them to mind, but I mean, it's up there. It has to be. Like, it's clearly a really bad one, like, to the point of, why would you ever watch baseball again? It's surprising he stayed with it, knowing that he could lose a game that badly. Wouldn't that scare you off? Maybe that's why he's so good. He never wanted to be in that position. I don't know.
Maybe that was it. Maybe the 1996 Phillies fueled Mike Trout's motivation to become a better baseball player than he had ever seen on TV growing up.
I never want to feel the way those Phillies players field. word that exists.
Well, I think that's as good a place as any to draw our narrative to a close. And things worked out pretty well for Mike Trout. Things did not work out pretty well for the 1996 Phillies. But folks, thanks so much for listening to The Dirty Inning. We love bringing you new episodes of Phillies futility from the far and recent past. Be sure to subscribe, download, and rate all the podcasts that are a part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hit and Season and Continued Success. And yes, we will be back in 2 weeks with another episode of your favorite Phillies podcast, The Dirty Inning. Thanks so much for listening.
Bye.
This episode of The Dirty Inning contained information from the following sources. Small Town Heroes, Images of Minor League Baseball by Hank Davis. Game of My Life, Memorable Stories of Phillies Baseball by Bob Gordon. Ball Player by Chipper Jones and Carol R. Walton. The February 10th, 1993 edition of the Philadelphia Daily News. The August 8th, 1996 and April 5th, 1995 editions of the Philadelphia Inquirer. The August 7th, 1998 edition of the Atlanta Constitution. And the July 19th, 1989 edition of the Tyrone Daily Herald.